Back at it once again, you and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, February 11th, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today. I open the show wondering why there's a constant debate about education funding in Connecticut. What's the breaking point for state taxpayers on this? Hearst Connecticut Media senior columnist and editor Dan Hard dropped by to talk about the growing election year tax and spending battles at the state capitol. Columnist and blogger Chris Powell joined us for his monthly visit to chat about Governor Ned Lamont's tone at his recent State of the State address. Did he go too far regarding ICE? And CBS News congressional correspondent Nicole Killian briefed us on the current ongoing talks to try and fund the Department of Homeland Security heading into the weekend.
So I'll open the big program today with this simple question that we can apply to a lot of different areas in life. You can just rattle them off in your brain, but it's a simple question I want to put out there. And I'm not doing this with any sort of ill will toward people who educate our kids. I have the utmost respect for school superintendents, school administrators, teachers. I don't think I could be a teacher. I always thought about giving it a run, but I'm not maybe that kind of a guy. I don't know. But when it comes to school funding, when is enough enough? And we seem to hear, and Chris just did that story about the Bridgeport Board of Ed asking for an incredible amount of money. And listen, I'm not in the negotiations there. I have no idea what their budget requests are. Neither have I ever served on a school board or a teacher's union. I'm just looking at this as, you know, the dopey guy in the corner here who gets paid to flap his gums. But I think sometimes I try to ask questions, kind of the questions that regular people would ask. And I went through, and we have a bunch of stuff coming up on the show today. Three great guests. We'll keep you updated on the Nancy Guthrie case, in case you didn't hear. They had a person of interest, but he was let go. So more on that coming up top and bottom of every hour. But I look at what I want to talk about today and what I think may be important to you folks. And I see this headline. It's in the Hearst papers. I'm looking at it on the side of the Stamford Advocate. And in quotes, it says, "A train wreck for public education. : Connecticut leaders warn Lamont budget leaves schools short." Okay, I understand. I tend to follow what goes on in my local town. And I covered this once when I was a news reporter out there sticking a microphone in people's faces. So, you know, the days are fond to me on this. But is it just me? Yes, it is, Paul. Well, no, give me a chance here. Is it just me, or do we get this Armageddon, the sky is falling, the world is ending story every year about funding education? I know education is important. I get that. We don't want to crank out a carloads of dullards out of our schools. All right, I understand that. But every year, oh, we don't have enough money. We don't have enough money. To which I ask, with all due respect to people who teach, to people who are paraprofessionals, to people who serve on school boards, to people who serve on boards of education, whatever, finance committees, when is enough enough? In other words, I sit here and I say, again, is it just say, hey, we don't have enough? Let's go to the ATM again and again and again and again and again. And I understand education people, people who educate our kids, staff members, all of that. I understand there are pressures here. But aren't there pressures on every other department, state department, city or town department? And you wonder why, if you know any people in the real estate business that I do, like I do, and they say, geez, I almost had a sale in that town again last week, but I couldn't because the property taxes are too high. Well, what's the main contributor to the property taxes? It's cost of the school system. And again, I get it. We public education is a cornerstone of the U.S. But when is enough enough? Well, we don't have enough money. You know what? Figure it out. Because you know who doesn't have enough money? Police departments, fire departments, EMT, municipal workers, commercial businesses, small business people. Lots of people don't have enough money. And I'm reading this story here by Natasha Sokoloff in the Stanford Advocate. You have people, we spend about $25,000 to $26,000 a year in this state. We are among annually the top three, four, or five states spending money on education. And yet every year it's we need more and more and more and more. Why is that? Is it that just these contracts cause everybody to make more money? I understand that. Everybody wants to make more money. Is special education expensive? Sure as hell is. I know people that have dealt with that for their kids up front. But when is enough enough? And the state keeps saying, well, you know, we've got to amend the education cost sharing grant. Well, you've been saying that for over the past 10 years, and you've done squat. You've done nothing. All you do is you treat taxpayers like ATMs. Oh, we need more money. Why is that? Well, you know, there are raises coming up in the teachers' unions and all this. And again, I don't like, I'm not trying to disparage anybody. I'm really not. But it gets to a point where how much more can taxpayers take? A friend of mine is a real estate agent, and she told me, I mean, one of the worst towns right now is Hamden. You have, for example, property owners in Hamden that are having to drop the price. She told me this, having to drop prices on houses $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 because the property taxes are so high. And what drives property taxes? School spending. And we already spend upwards of $25,000 to $26,000 a year in this state, on average, educating students. When is enough enough? You can't just keep going to the spigot. You can't. Like I said, in this state, we talk about how smart we are, and then we bitch and moan about stuff, and we never figure it out. I'm not saying it's easy. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So you tell me, and I'd love to hear if you're from the education community. I'm not bashing you. I'm really not. But we better figure this out. Because you've got property taxes everywhere. Fairfield County, New Haven County, Tolland, Windham, Hartford counties. This is ridiculous. It's killing people. And yet, the education people say, no, not enough. I need more. Are you serious? You know, my father used to say, hey, kid, it doesn't grow on trees. He was right. So you tell me, and I understand maybe you don't want to come on the radio because you may be on a board of education. You may be a teacher. You may be a paraprofessional. I'd love for you to come on the radio. But if you want to text me, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. They're calling the Lamont budget, and the governor is not cutting education. He's keeping it flat. A train wreck. Really? 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 Keeping a budget flat is a train wreck? You're kidding. You're kidding. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. And I'd love to hear from educators, from professionals, if you want to come on the radio, or you can text me here. I just, this is part of my, I'm not directing this at educators. I'm not directing this at school officials. I'm not. I'm really not. God bless you, teachers and folks. I get it. But when I see headlines like this, it drives me nuts as a taxpayer. They're calling it a train wreck for public education that the governor is leaving the federal, the state level education handouts, the education cost sharing stuff flat, and then the towns and cities have to make it up. Okay, I get that. But what does that tell you about how things are running? If just a budget that is flat, not like he's done massive cuts here, but we're referring now to flat budgeting as a train wreck? Come on. I'm telling you, I don't know what to do here. But again, and people, and I've had guests on this show numerous times saying, well, the first thing we have to do is change the education cost sharing fund or grants, and we never do it. So again, are we ever going to fix this or not? Or are people about to say, homeowners saying, hey, enough is enough. I can't afford any more property taxes. How do we fix this? Let's go to Elda in Newtown to start us off today. Elda, hi, you're on WICC. How are you?
Good, thank you, and you?
I'm good. What do you think of this?
Well, I can't speak as far as how the state does the financing in assisting towns with their education, but what I can speak to in generalities is when you're comparing Connecticut to other states of the union, yes, we invest a lot of money in our public education, but that's also reflected in the quality.
Okay.
My nephew's wife graduated from UNC, obviously a very good school, and had several friends who graduated with teaching degrees down, and they're working in North Carolina, South Carolina. Those educators are earning on average $20,000 to $25,000 a year. That's kind of hard to live on when you have at least a bachelor's degree, if not an advanced degree. Secondly, a lot of our many of the teachers here in Connecticut have to have their advanced degrees versus if you compare it to other states. So something to keep in mind when discussing all of this is you also get what you pay for. You know, nobody likes high taxes, but it's also the quality of the education, you know, that you're getting because you are paying more. Both my children were special education students. And I got to say, yes, it, you know, it definitely was not cheap. And we were very fortunate. That our town covered those costs. But my daughter now, who has Asperger's, is successfully working full-time. She has her own insurance, her own phone plan. She is completely independent and not on any state assistance.
Yeah, I mean, Elda, it's not, and I know you understand this. I just want people who understand who may be just tuning in here. I'm not discrediting anybody who's a good educator or the outcomes here. But in anything where every year people are asked to pay more and more and more, it's tough. And my tendency here is to ask, when do we get to a point? And if you know anybody in real estate, Elda, ask them. I mean, I have friends of mine that are brokers who are losing sales because the property taxes are so high. I don't know what we do. I've always looked, do we increase the state sales tax? I mean, I don't know, but to me, I just don't see this ending. And that's the problem.
What would be interesting, I know in Newtown, we have our town budget is voted on by referendum. And they have, it's of one vote, but they do split up the the education budget versus the town budget.
Yeah.
And people definitely get very involved.
Yeah.
And speak. So it would be kind of interesting if maybe other communities, would be a lot of work for them to adopt that type of thing. But by the same token, it may also create greater mm-hmm. awareness that you can see now, okay, now I see why mm-hmm. I'm paying X amount of dollars, because
yeah.
it's going to this. And they will actually have the line-by-line budget, so you can see exactly
yeah.
you know, what they're asking for and why they're asking for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, what they say, sunshine is the best illumination on anything. Elda, thank you. Appreciate the call there. Elda in Newtown. Yeah, I mean, folks, it's just... Talk to anybody you know who may be in the real estate business and ask them, hey, are you losing sales, or is the deal breaker or deal maker here the property taxes here? And a lot of times if it is, you know, listen, it goes to pay school resources, and I have nothing against that, but when we are referring to a flat budget in a state that's already top five in spending on students, when people are referring to that as a train wreck, we've got a big problem. Right around this time, every midweek Wednesday, Dan Haar, kind enough to join us from Hearst, Connecticut Media. Mr. Haar, good afternoon, sir. How are you, sir?
Good afternoon. First time caller, long time listener.
Gee, thanks for making the call. Boy, Dan, I got to tell you, we're really now in gear here in the Capitol with the election year fully underway. And Dan, by what these proposals and counterproposals look like, it seems that both sides there realize that folks may be looking, what, Dan, for a little bit of relief, even some token gestures here? What do you make of all these plans and counterplans going on here?
Well, I think the word meaningful is at issue, right? In other words, when Lamont issues a proposal for a $200 or $400 one-time check,
yeah.
he refers specifically, he and his office refer to that as meaningful. And the Republicans and the liberal Democrats refer to that as not meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so interestingly here, you have the two sides coming together
yeah.
so much that when I wrote a column, as you may have seen, I don't know if we didn't talk about it last week. No,
yeah.
Or maybe we did, criticizing the fact that people making as much as $400,000, couples
yeah.
making joint filers making $400,000.
I saw that, yeah.
Are still going to get $400 of a rebate.
Yeah.
Right? And the argument is, well, they're still middle class, right? Well, they're in the middle class. So the Republicans want their assistance to generally go to people who are making $200,000 for joint and $100,000 for individuals.
Okay.
So I asked Steve Harding, the Senate Republican leader, during the press conference yesterday,
yeah.
if you oppose Lamont giving money to what we might call rich people, $400,000 in income,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, you could debate about whether that's rich. I don't think they need $400.
No.
Then would you be willing, and he's looking for, as you know, and you've probably been talking about it, and we can talk about it here,
yeah.
he's looking for a $1 billion tax cut.
Yeah,
in a variety of places, mostly the income. A lot of it is income tax.
Yeah,
a lot of it is the cutting the public benefits,
mm-hmm.
putting that back on the away from rates. So, or actually, that's separate from the billion. My point is, if the Republicans are hell bent on giving most or all of the assistance to lower income people, would they be willing to accept Senator Looney, the Senate president's proposal, which hasn't been rolled out yet, but which we know is coming, for a half a point or a point of capital gains tax, or a half a percent increase at the high end for people making more than, what's the high end now, $600,000,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's 6.99% going up to 7%. And of course, their answer was, we're focused on cutting taxes. But as somebody pointed out to me, he didn't say no. Right. So
yeah.
you really do have the two ends coming together in the form of let's let's target the aid on the working poor and the working class.
And I find it interesting, Dan, and looking at that, and yeah, I did see your column on that. It's interesting that both sides, Dan, now, I mean, they've heard the rumbling, right? Both sides say, we can't just sit here on our economic laurels, even if it is, as you say, symbolic. Maybe we can just tell people, okay, we hear you, and the people and taxpayers of all ilks in the state are saying, hey, hello, what are we going to do? Like, you know, like, hello, are you, is this thing on? Are you hearing me? You know, I never quite seen both sides come out with ideas like this almost simultaneously.
Yeah, the one thing I would point out is the do-nothing option, which is what we've been doing for the last 6 years,
yes,
is pretty damn good for tax cutting.
Yeah.
Right? Because we've put $10 billion into the pensions, mm-hmm. and that essentially saves $850 million mm-hmm. a year for the next 25 years. Right? So what that means is that we've been able to keep up with inflation without raising taxes by... A, incomes are higher, and so percent taxes are higher. But really, we're saving $800 million a
yeah.
year that we would have had to put into the pensions that we can now put into other things. I guess that the Republicans say that's not good enough. You need to give it back to people in their pocket,
yeah.
right? But it's preventing some of the usual spending creep. I think we would be remiss if we didn't go through the list of some of these things.
Sure.
That are being
no, go ahead.
Around
yeah,
here.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've got the one-time rebate.
Yeah.
Right. We've got the income tax rates cut. And to be clear, the Republicans in the Senate want to eliminate the entire lowest bracket so that people at the bottom are not really paying anything.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the corporate tax rate. You've got narrowing the state sales tax to exclude food and clothing.
I saw that.
Right?
Yeah.
You've got child tax credits. You've got property tax credits. That's what the House Republicans are going to propose, some significant child tax credits.
Okay.
I think. I'm sorry. Property tax credits,
yeah.
not child tax credits. And then here's one that you haven't heard about.
Okay.
But it's quietly being talked about, and there's a little bit of a mini debate. Piggybacking on the federal elimination of tax on tips and overtime up to certain thresholds. And I did a little reporting on this, and it turns out that it would cost $200 million to piggyback.
Yeah.
Right? And now that's not something that Democrats are embracing,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of out there. It's being talked about. And so for example, at 4.5%, a
yeah.
server who makes $12,000 in tips would save $560 a year.
All right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what you're doing is you're the reason that a lot of people don't like it is because it's too targeted. Right? It's only for people
sure.
that make tips
yeah.
and overtime.
Yeah.
Right? But overtime is obviously a broader population.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's worth going through what some of these things are. And of course, each thing, you can put a lever on each thing and saying how much magnitude, you know, how much property tax credit, how much child tax credit.
Exactly.
How much do we exempt food and clothing?
As long as the discussion is out there. And finally, I know you wanted to touch on this in about the minute we have left. Our president, Mr. Trump, said the other day he believes that it was subterfuge that got Richard Blumenthal elected to the U.S. Senate. Dan, is there any evidence of that?
No. There are two lies going on here from Mr. Trump,
yeah.
Among many. And one is that he's using the fact that Richard Blumenthal,
yeah.
who is, there basically are six Dick Blumenthals, as you know, running around,
yeah.
because nobody else could cover that much ground. He's using the fact that he gets reelected over and over again
yeah.
as proof that the Connecticut election system is fraudulent,
okay.
which is, that's just midsummer madness. Right. That's just crazy talk. Right. That's simply ridiculous. Who was the last person that ran against Blumenthal? It was Lior Levy. Like,
yeah.
Not a tight race.
No.
I don't know if she got the 40%.
Yeah.
The mandatory 40%.
Yeah.
In any case, the other lie is that that Trump continues to say that Blumenthal claims he was a war hero. About three times, Blumenthal said, while I was serving in Vietnam instead of saying while I was serving during Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That was an untruth. He apologized for it. Trump continues to say Blumenthal claims he was a war hero, and it is a knowing lie. He's lying.
Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media. Check him out. What's your next piece coming out? What should we watch for, Dan?
I can't say.
Oh.
I am writing what I can say is there's a story I'm writing about a solar farm installation. Solar farms are starting to creep into places where they don't belong.
Oh.
And I'm going to weigh in on that.
All right, Dan Haar. Dan, be good. We'll chat with you next week. Thank you, sir.
Great to be here.
All right. Now, solar. Wow, about that. Dan saying, hey, there's solar farms where maybe there shouldn't be. Once a month or so, we like to check in with Chris Powell. You know him, you love him. He's been around the state here for a long time, writing, I think, some of the best editorials around, saying what needs to be said. And you can check him out, ChrisPowellColumn.com, ChrisPowellColumn.com. Mr. Powell, how are you, sir? How are you holding up?
Well, I'm plowed, and my driveway's clear, too.
That's good. Did it take a while?
Days, weeks. We're still working on it yesterday.
Really? Wow. Yeah. That was a doozy. You know what else was a doozy, Chris? And I'm glad you wrote about it. The governor at his State of the State address, or pretty much more of a campaign address. But, I thought that the language about ICE, Chris, and you tell me whether you believe it or not, I don't think this at heart was the Ned Lamont we know. I just think this was red meat. This was chum in the water, knowing that he's facing a reelection.
Yeah, he seemed to feel very much obliged to pander to the far left people in his party. He the main part of that speech was a call for nullification and insurrection against the federal government's enforcement of immigration law in Connecticut. And the irony about it was that even as he was calling for nullification and insurrection, and kicking ICE out of the state, he said that we're keeping. He was talking to the ICE agents. He says, we're keeping Connecticut safe without you. But even as he was giving his speech, just a few blocks away in federal court in Hartford, the feds were getting a guilty plea to illegal reentry of the United States by a Jamaican guy who'd come to Connecticut. And at the point of his conviction, he was subject to an arrest warrant, a Connecticut arrest warrant that had not been served against him. Connecticut had not been able to track him down for, I guess, the charges were threatening and there was something else. Mm-hmm. I forget what it was, but nevertheless, it was a violence-related crime. There was a warrant out for him in Connecticut. Connecticut didn't track him down. The feds tracked him down, and the feds got him convicted for illegal reentry to the United States, and he's going to serve 22 months in prison and then get deported back to Jamaica again. But here's the governor saying, at the Capitol, oh, we can take care of, Connecticut without you. Well, no, Connecticut didn't run this guy down. The feds ran this guy down, and he was convicted of violence and then came back to Connecticut. It was breach of peace and threatening that there was a state warrant out for him, but the state didn't catch him. The feds caught him. I mean, the facts contradicted the governor. I mean, the ICE has run down many serious criminals in Connecticut that Connecticut did not run down. What the governor was saying is federal agents shouldn't even come to Connecticut. They shouldn't have any authority here. He sounded just like George Wallace and Orville Faubus and all the segregationist southern governors of the last century who didn't want the federal government's agents coming into their states to make them obey federal law and the federal constitution. I mean, it's like he was just totally with the nullification and insurrection people. The thing was, all the members of his party in the legislature stood up and cheered and whooped and applauded. I mean, this is This is madness. And maybe the bigger madness about it is journalism in Connecticut doesn't even point this out.
No, Chris, they won't press him on that. They as you did with the insurrection line. Chris, but I wonder, and again, and I said here on the show after running clips, I said, you know, Chris, part of a great politician, and you and I have seen these people over the years, in sensitive subjects like this, will say to themselves, or even when they craft the speech, look, I know people who voted for me, and I know people who didn't vote for me. And I can still say things to make the people who voted for me happy. But, Chris, at least respect the other people and say, hey, I know this is a touchy subject. I understand that. We aim to do better here in Connecticut. I will meet with federal officials, whatever. But I was shocked, Chris, as you say, at the tone of that, the defiance. And you're right. I even asked myself, I said, boy, somewhere even George Wallace is shaking his head here. It was just so unstatesperson-like. I was shocked by it. I was.
Well, it was secessionist. It was nullificationist. It was insurrectionary. It's just so ironic, you know, when Trump's people invaded the Capitol, that was insurrection. What the hell is this? It's the same thing.
Yeah. Chris Powell is the guest. We'll get back to open phones momentarily at 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Also, Chris, you are pointing out in your latest column, I'm shocked, hypocrisy on housing and on the environment, Chris. Tell me it's not happening. It is, but go ahead and try and convince me.
Well, the environmental extremists in Connecticut, they want the legislature to pass a big new punitive tax on oil producers and natural gas producers. It's to punish them for their decades of producing the fuels that we use,
mm-hmm.
As if it's the fault of the producers that everybody in Connecticut is using oil and natural gas. But the environmental extremists they can't be seen to be calling for putting a tax on the users of the fuels they think are destroying the environment. No, they want to scapegoat the oil companies and the gas companies, as if the oil companies and the gas companies are making us use oil and gas. What these people really want, they want a big new wholesale tax on oil and gas. We already have a big wholesale tax on energy in Connecticut.
Yeah.
It's the gross receipts tax, which is estimated to add about 26 cents per gallon of the gas price.
Mm.
There's taxes on gas that we can see at the pump, but the gross receipts tax, which we already have, we can't see. The tax that the environmental extremists are proposing for Connecticut, we wouldn't be able to see at all. That would be a tax directly on the producers. And how would they recover it? Of course, they'd raise taxes.
Shocking.
They'd raise prices. And everybody in Connecticut would have to pay more for, oil and gas and electricity and heat. But people would blame the oil and gas producers. They wouldn't understand that the prices had gone up because their own governor and legislators had enacted a big hidden wholesale tax.
Mm-hmm.
The environmentalists really don't believe in their own issue. They don't believe their issue can persuade people. They want to destroy the oil and gas companies with hidden taxes. Well, we have enough hidden taxes in Connecticut. If we really should, have higher gas and oil prices, let's come out and do it in the open and say so.
Yeah.
And put the tax on as a sales tax that all of us who use oil and gas will have to pay, and we'll understand, who's responsible for it, and there'll be some possibility of political accountability. But the environmentalists can't stand that because they realize nobody'd ever go along with it.
Of course not, yes, because even Democrats drive cars and have to heat their homes. And finally, speaking of that, and homes, Chris Powell, we have been told now with the special session underway that something being bandied about as rent reform or landlord reform is next up on the docket.
Oh, the governor has endorsed a proposal to put rent control on apartment properties that are already existing, but they're purchased by new owners. He's also proposed or endorsed rent control on properties purchased by out-of-state owners, which is just the most cynical demagoguery. Let's put taxes on people who can't vote in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Rent control is the surest way to discourage housing construction. Mm-hmm. Why would anybody renovate or build apartments in Connecticut if he isn't sure he can make some money on it? We've got all sorts of apartment buildings and tenements in Connecticut whose rents are not high enough to support the maintenance.
Yeah.
You see what's going on in the concierge apartments in Rocky Hill.
Yeah.
These proposals for rent control show me the Democrats and the governor don't really think that their new housing bill is going to create much housing at all. They think that the only way they're going to get rents down is by rent control, which is the surest way to deter housing construction. The only way to get rents down is to unleash housing construction, to make sure people can build a lot of housing so that, the supply exceeds the demand.
Economics 101. Chris Powell, check it out, chrispowellcolumn.com. Chris, as always, thank you so much. Appreciate it. We'll talk in a few weeks. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, there you go. But in case you didn't know, because I've tried to remind you of this, there is a threat that the Department of Homeland Security may not have money to operate after this coming Friday, and supposedly there are talks, I guess, we haven't heard too much, to get DHS funded, but that is running into some roadblocks. Once again, we guess because of differences as to how ICE operates. So covering that for us right now in D.C., joining us live, CBS News congressional correspondent Nicole Killian. Nicole, it's Paul here in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Nicole, for the time. We appreciate it. So, basic question, is anything happening here that we were told, hey, a lot of Democrats want concessions on masks, on cameras, this and the other, an oversight body? What have we heard, if anything, on that?
Well, we do know both sides are talking, and that's what's key, and that's what's different from the last time that we saw a government shut down last fall, the longest in U.S. history, I might add. But that being said, to your point, there's still no resolution, and there's about 2 days until we hit this deadline for funding to potentially elapse for the Department of Homeland Security. So we're still waiting to see whether or not Democrats and Republicans can strike a deal.
And especially for somebody like, say, Chuck Schumer, Nicole, he's really got pressure on both sides, doesn't he? He's got his mainstream Democrats here saying, hey, don't do anything dumb. But yet on the progressive side, he's got pressure, I would imagine, Nicole, there as well.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of talking to both leader Schumer and rank-and-file Democrats, as of now, they seem to be in lockstep on this issue. Some rank-and-file Democrats have already come out saying that they are not going to support short-term funding for the Department of Homeland Security unless Democrats' proposals are addressed. So as of now, they're remaining unified. But again, kind of like with the last shutdown, we kind of have to see if anyone cracks. That being said, I think Democrats believe that polling and public opinion is on their side on this one, given the deadly shooting incidents involving Renee Good and Alex Preddy, where, the average American citizen could see that video for themselves and draw their own conclusions. And so because of that, I think Democrats feel that their position on this in terms of calling for some guardrails and restraints is warranted and supported by a majority of the American people.
All right. CBS News congressional correspondent Nicole Killian in D.C. Nicole, thank you. We appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You bet.
All right. There you go.